Okay, so I'm pretty new to the historical poetics thing too, but I'm going to give it a try. So, for Prinz, understanding prosodic theories contemporary with the Victorian poets that interest her is necessary for grasping the poetic thinking in their work. This paper will discuss the merits of using this model when examining a contemporary poem and the related issue of exemplarity. Using contemporary theories to examine a poem can be problematic. We don't have the benefit of hindsight. The movement from one historical moment to the next is seamless, and it can be hard to identify the best theories to use when reading the poem. I will focus on the poem "I Must Say That at First It Was Difficult Work" by Matthew Welton, and look at how the terms lyric and experimental can be used when discussing this contemporary poem. Okay, so to situate Welton, he is a contemporary British poet currently working at the University of Nottingham, and the poem is from his unusually titled collection, which I'll just read now. Sorry, it's a very long title. Okay, so the title of the collection is "We Needed Coffee, But We'd Got Ourselves Convinced That The Later We Left It, The Better It Would Taste, And As The Country Grew Flatter, And The Roads Became Quiet, And The Dusk Began To Colour The Sky, You Could Guess From The Way We Returned To The Radio And Unfolded The Map, Or Commented On The View That The Tang Of Determination Had Overtaken Our Thoughts, And When, Fidgety And Untalkative, But Almost Home, We Drew Up Outside The All-Night Restaurant, It Felt Like We Might Just Stay There In The Car, Listening to the engine and the gentle sound of the wind." Okay, so that was released in 2009. And so there's been like a divide between so-called experimental poetry and mainstream lyric poetry for ages, but the binary myths still permeate a lot of contemporary poetry criticism. Simon Turner provides examples of this ongoing argument in his article Arranging Excursions to Disparate Worlds, citing Neil McDevitt's Contra Avant-Garde, and in particular Don Patterson's introduction to the 2004 New British Poetry, in which he basically trash talks that everything that is postmodern. He refers to anything outside lyric mainstream as boring, except for a few attractive voices, repeatedly sets up an us and them divide, and uses terms like tribes and allegiances. What is gained from these arguments, I don't really understand. They're boring, but they keep reoccurring. And I don't want to spend much time on this because these manifesto-like statements, which come from both sides, to be fair, shut down ways of thinking and understanding. And more importantly, they ignore what is going on in the actual poems. Terms like the lyric and experimental are often used as a kind of shortcut. They are a means of categorizing a poem without thinking about its history or the ways in which experimental and lyrical components of a poem can work together to form a cohesive whole that make meaning through the way that the components relate to each other. The term hybrid has become a popular label for an intermediate category, and a number of anthologies have made a point of emphasizing this in-between genre. Some examples of this are Voice Recognition, 21 Poets for the 21st Century, City State, New London Poetry, and Identity Parade, New British Poets and Irish Poets, all of which came out the same year as Welton's poem. Simon Turner goes on to point out that the editors of these anthologies are frustratingly vague as to what these new forms might look like. In their introductions, they use terms like modern, postmodern, experimental, avant-garde, post-avant, formalist, lyric, and performance poetry. This points to a problem in contemporary criticism. In the race to categorize or place new kinds of poetry, these really broad terms are used before taking the time to really pick apart what's actually going on in a poem. A hybrid is usually characterized as combining two features, that of a mainstream lyric and an experimental one. This reproduces and supports the binary and makes it sound like a compromise while ignoring the complex and interrelated ways that meaning can be made in a poem. Welton's work technically falls under the category of hybrid as he draws on elements of the lyric tradition and experiments in the vein of the Ulupo, but addressing his work through a strictly contemporary lens reduces potential readings of his poems. To fully grasp the poetic thinking at play in I Must Say, one must look at the longer histories of the Ulupo and the lyric. Jonathan Culler's theory of the lyric is useful for looking at how the lyric functions in this poem, because he avoids simplistic takes on the lyric and highlights the importance of theory with a broader historical scope. It's important to note that most of the writers who perpetuate this kind of lyric experimental binary are poets themselves or poet critics who work in the field and have a tight historical focus. In contrast, Culler is a literary theorist rather than a poet. He approaches these questions differently and with an academic distance. The work of the Ulupo has largely been an inquiry into the literary consequences of the use of formal constraints. And it is thanks to that proceduralism is accepted as being experimental. Matthew Welton's praxis stems from this ethos. However, it's important to consider the ways in which Welton's poetry differs from the Ulupo's. To put it simply, the goal of the Ulupo is to invent new theorems and constraints. The poem, as a standalone object, is not their first priority. Usually, they value structure and procedure over the evocation of sensory experience. Conversely, Welton is wary of formal abstraction and careful to counteract it with features of lyric poetry and often children's verse. The term lyric poetry is contentious. However, for my purposes, examples of the defining traits of the genre are cultivation of rhythm, line breaks, musicality, length, themes, the poem's subjective quality, and its short anecdotal nature. Although I must say is built around a rule, Welton is careful never to foreground them to the point where the rule becomes the main event of the poem. "I must say at first it was difficult work," was a comment made by Raymond Roussel in regards to his composition method described in How I Wrote Certain of My Books. Roussel composed a text by constructing two sentences from multi-word quasi-homophones or homonyms and then used these as the first and last sentences of his narrative. Though this is not the composition method that Welton used, we can see how it inspired his poem. "I Must Say" is a collection of 36 sentences. The first is a near homophone of the title, which is then followed by another line that is loosely homophonic to that line, and so on. And I might read or attempt to read a few stanzas, because it really does invite you to say the words like a kid's rhyme, although it's a bit of a tongue twister, so I'll find it tricky. So, "A malaise that affects the demented at first, a masseuse with a thirst for delicious liqueurs, a masseur who's inferring that discipline hurts, a mosquito, a butterfly, a tickler, a worm, a mouse with white fur was sick in the water, a mushroom that occurs in deciduous woods, an assailant who's certain of judicial mercy, and I'm saving the termites for further research, and most of the term he was dead to the world, and my cousin whose burps are not typical burps, and myxomatosis has stiffened its fur. Aramaic inverts the intransitive verbs as potatoes emerge from the depths of the earth. I'm arranging excursions to disparate worlds. I'm assured there's a version that is technically worse. I'm a surgeon who's working with domicile birds. I'm elated to learn. I'm in step with the herd." The poem takes the reader through repeated sounds and errors in translation, building like a game of Chinese whispers until the reader arrives at the last sentence, unassuming, furtive, stiff, and absurd, which could be a description of the poem itself. Welton elaborates on the title and the composition method, saying, "I must say that at first was a difficult work" is how Roussel's description of his method of composition is given in Michel Foucault in his study of Death and the Labyrinth, The World of Raymond Roussel. And more specifically, it is how Foucault's version of Roussel's description of his method is conveyed in Charles Ruart's translation of Foucault's book. So the phrase, "I must say that at first it was difficult work," which is both the title for the piece and the grounds on which it was written, comes not from Roussel as such, but from Ruart's version of Foucault's version of Roussel. The poem is an exercise based on the versions and translations that originally created the sentence, I must say that at first it was difficult work. This extended experiment highlights how Welton uses curiosity, delight, and play to raise interesting questions about translation. The poem, I Must Say, isn't a representation of an event, it is an event. Even when entirely written, sound in its rhythms and patterns is what happens in the lyric. The poetic experience is contained within the reading of the poem. It is not a description, it is not mimetic, it is a machine that produces a poetic event. The pleasure of this poetic event is both dependent on the meaning of the words, like the striking character and characters and the images, and independent of the meaning of the words, so the pleasure of the sound and rhythm. In Theory of the Lyric, Culler writes that rhythm gives the lyric a somatic quality that novels and other extended forms lack. The experience of rhythm, linking it to the body and perhaps to rhythms of other various natural processes, contributes to a different sort of pleasure from that promoted in novels. Culler quotes Isabel Armstrong, who notes her experience of being fixated on a rhythm, but not being able to recall the poem. She recalls a pulse halfway between a sound and a pressure, not a sign, not a notation or a code, but something else. Like Armstrong, Welton found a compulsion in the rhythm of the phrase, "I must say that it was difficult work." Welton's poem is driven by what Armstrong describes as the sound system of the poem's language and the somatic pressure it encourages. The poem asks for words, but is independent of them. She goes on to say that when the lines did come into her head eventually, she discovered that she got some of the words wrong. This implies that for Armstrong at least, the rhythmic pattern of the poem inheres more strongly in memory than specific lexical content. This isn't exactly the case for Welton. The appeal of his poem lies equally in the odd imagery, striking characters, and the sense of humour, which is underlined by the rhythmic and phonetic clinamen of water. It doesn't have the same rhyming sound, and it ends with an unstressed, not a stressed syllable. Welton writes that the title phrase seemed to have an attraction of its own, which may be why he departed a little from the method described by Roussel. I must say that at first it was difficult work, and Isabel Armstrong's experience of being fixated on a rhythm of a poem poses a problem for notions of exemplarity. If, as Prince suggests, we read theories of versification that are contemporary with the poem, this still doesn't account for the intensely intimate, somatic, and personal interaction with a poem. The impetus for Welton to write the poem stemmed from the attraction to the rhythm and sounds of the words. Simon Jarvis writes, "For subversive poetics, poems are not only representations, but also quite singular machines, devices for body modification. The recovery of any partly obscured historical practice requires an active recomposition, not only the collecting of representations. We must fire up the machines in person if we are to understand their histories. Absent recomposition poetics can't write the history of verse practice, only the history of what has been said about it." So it can be too simple to use a poem as a proof of a preconceived claim. In the case of Welton's poem, it would be easy to use his poem as to support the label of an experimental lyric hybrid. But experiencing the way that somatizing a poem can expand into the mind challenges preconceived ideas that come with this label. Isabel Armstrong expands on this idea in her essay Hegel, The Time of Rhythm, The Time of Rhyme, because she speaks of a mental and physical self in motion rather than a subjective implicitly fixed in rather than a subjectivity implicitly fixed in the positions assigned to it by codes and structural forces. Armstrong quotes Simon Jarvis, who analyzes the way that the movement of consciousness finds patterns of recurrent excursion and return in rhyme, whose structures parallels the recursive and outgoing and coming back of the mind. He argues that this outgoing and coming back is a phenomenological experience, not one that can be reduced to a simple movement of the mind alone, and one that alters the phenomenological experience itself. This process of text and sound opening up into the mind is tied to the reader's individual experience of a poem. Armstrong says that rhyme is a making explicit of an experience that is cognitive, and although Welton's poem is not based on rhyme, this idea can be applied to Welton's experiments with homophones too. She writes that cognition lies in the structural act of outgoing and return itself, which the subject knows and feels that it knows. Form and structure, think and feel. Through this externalization, they become modes of thinking and feeling. This articulates the movement of the outgoing and return that builds the 36 lines of I must say at first it's difficult work, and how the reader processes them. The echoing effect not only sets the self in motion, it sets ideas in motion and brings them into dialogue. As Armstrong says, meter means through the interplay of relationships it makes, not through any meaning intrinsic to it.